themselves. The first time I dated her was when we were in the 8th grade. Most of the boys in our class wanted to take her to the 8th grade graduation dance, and I was surprised. I was pretty proud when she said she would go with me. We were both 12. My dad lent me the car and I drove her to the dance. The more I saw her, the more I liked her. The whole family, too. There wasn't any other family like them. Not around here, not that I know of. Mr. Clutter may have been more strict about some things, religion and so on, but he never tried to make you feel he was right and you were wrong. We lived 3 miles west of the Clutter place. I used to walk it back and forth, but I always worked summers, and last year I'd saved enough to buy my own car, a 55 Ford. So I drove over there, got there a little after 7. I didn't see anybody on the road or on the lane that leads up to the house, or anybody outside. Just old Teddy. He barked at me. The lights were on downstairs, in the living room and in Mr. Clutter's office. The second floor was dark, and I figured Mrs. Clutter must be asleep, if she was home. You never knew whether she was or not, and I never asked. But I found out I was right, because later in the evening Kenyon wanted to practice his horn. He played baritone horn in the school band, and Nancy told him not to because he would wake up Mrs. Clutter. Anyway, when I got there, they had finished supper and Nancy had cleaned up, put all the dishes in the dishwasher, and the three of them, the two kids and Mr. Clutter, were in the living room. So we sat around like any other night, Nancy and I on the couch, and Mr. Clutter in his chair, that stuffed rocker. He wasn't watching the television so much as he was reading a book. A Rover Boy, one of Kenyon's books. Once he went out to the kitchen and came back with 2 apples. He offered one to me, but I didn't want it, so he ate them both. He had very white teeth. He said apples were why. Nancy was wearing socks and soft slippers, blue jeans, I think a green sweater. She was wearing a gold wristwatch and an ID bracelet I gave her last January for her 16th birthday, with her name on one side and mine on the other. And she had on a ring, some little silver thing she bought a summer ago when she went to Colorado with the Kidwells. It wasn't my ring, our ring. See, a couple weeks back, she got sore at me and said she was going to take off our ring for a while. When your girl does that, it means you're on probation. I mean, sure, we had fusses. Everybody does. All the kids that go steady. What happened was I went to this friend's wedding, the reception, and drank a beer. 1 bottle of beer, and Nancy got to hear about it. Some tattle told her I was roaring drunk. Well, she was stone, wouldn't say hello for a week. But lately we'd been getting on good as ever, and I believe she was about ready to wear our ring again. Okay. The first show was called The Man and the Challenge, Channel 11, about some fellas in the Arctic. Then we saw a Western, and after that a spy adventure. 5 Fingers. Mike Hammer came on at 9:30. Then the news. But Kenyon didn't like anything, mostly because we wouldn't let him pick the programs. He criticized everything, and Nancy kept telling him to hush up. They always quibbled, but actually, they were very close. Closer than most brothers and sisters. I guess partly it was because they'd been alone together so much, what with Mrs. Clutter away and Mr. Clutter gone to Washington or wherever. I know Nancy loved Kenyon very specially, but I don't think even she or anybody exactly understood him. He seemed to be off somewhere. You never knew what he was thinking, never even knew if he was looking at you, on account of he was slightly cockeyed. Some people said he was a genius, and maybe it was true. He sure did read a lot. But like I say, he was restless. He didn't want to watch the TV. He wanted to practice his horn. And when Nancy wouldn't let him, I remember Mr. Clutter told him why didn't he go down to the basement, the recreation room where nobody could hear him. But he didn't want to do that either. The phone rang once. Twice? Gosh, I can't remember. Except that once the phone rang and Mr. Clutter answered it in his office. The door was open, that sliding door between the living room and the office, and I heard him say Van, so I knew he was talking to his partner, Mr. Van Vliet, and I heard him say that he had a headache but that it was getting better, and said he'd see Mr. Van Vliet on Monday. When he came back, yes, the Mike Hammer was just over. 5 minutes of news, then the weather report. Mr. Clutter always perked up when the weather report came on. It's all he ever really waited for. Like, the only thing that interested me was the sports, which came on next. After the sports ended, that was 10:30, and I got up to go. Nancy walked me out. We talked a while and made a date to go to the movies Sunday night. A picture all the girls were looking forward to. Blue denim. Then she ran back in the house and I drove away. It was as clear as day. The moon was so bright and cold and kind of windy. A lot of tumbleweed blowing about. But that's all I saw. Only now when I think back, I think somebody must have been hiding there. Maybe down among the trees. Somebody just waiting for me to leave. The travelers stopped for dinner at a restaurant in Great Bend. Perry, down to his last $15, was ready to settle for root beer and a sandwich, but Dick said no. They needed a solid tuck-in, and never mind the cost, the tab was his. They ordered 2 steaks medium rare, baked potatoes, French fries, fried onions, succotash, side dishes of macaroni and hominy, salad with Thousand Island dressing, cinnamon rolls, apple pie and ice cream, and coffee. To top it off, they visited a drugstore and selected cigars. In the same drugstore, they also bought 2 thick rolls of adhesive tape. As the black Chevrolet regained the highway and hurried on across a countryside imperceptibly ascending toward the colder, cracker-dry climate of the high wheat plains, Perry closed his eyes and dozed off into a food-dazed semi-slumber, from which he woke to hear a voice reading the 11 o'clock news. He rolled down a window and bathed his face in the flood of frosty air. Dick told him they were in Finney County. "We crossed the line 10 miles back," he said. The car was going very fast. Signs, their messages ignited by the car's headlights, flared up, flew by. "See the polar bears. Burtis Motors. World's largest free swim pool. Wheatlands Motel." And finally, a bit before street lamps began, "Howdy, stranger. Welcome to Garden City, a friendly place." They skirted the northern rim of the town. No one was abroad at this nearly midnight hour, and nothing was open except a string of desolately brilliant service stations. Dick turned into one. Herds Phillips 66. A youngster appeared and asked, "Fill her up?" Dick nodded, and Perry, getting out of the car, went inside the station, where he locked himself in the men's room. His legs pained him, as they often did. They hurt as though his old accident had happened 5 minutes before. He shook 3 aspirins out of a bottle, chewed them slowly, for he liked the taste, and then drank water from the basin tap. He sat down on the toilet, stretched out his legs and rubbed them, massaging the almost unbendable knees. Dick had said they were almost there, only 7 miles more. He unzippered a pocket of his windbreaker and brought out a paper sack. Inside it were the recently purchased rubber gloves. They were glue-covered, sticky and thin, and as he inched them on, one tore. Not a dangerous tear, just a split between the fingers, but it seemed to him an omen. The doorknob turned, rattled. Dick said, "Want some candy? They got a candy machine out here." "No." "You okay?" "I'm fine." "Don't be all night." Dick dropped a dime in a vending machine, pulled the lever, and picked up a bag of jelly beans. Munching, he wandered back to the car and lounged there, watching the young attendant's efforts to rid the windshield of Kansas dust and the slime of battered insects. The attendant, whose name was James Spore, felt uneasy. Dick's eyes and sullen expression and Perry's strange, prolonged sojourn in the lavatory disturbed him. The next day, he reported to his employer, "We had some tough customers in here last night," but he did not think, then or for the longest while, to connect the visitors with the tragedy in Holcomb. Dick said, "Kinda slow around here." "Sure is," James Spore said. "You're the only body stopped here since 2 hours. Where you coming from?"
"Kansas City."
"Here to hunt?"
"Just passing through."
"On our way to Arizona."
"We got jobs waiting there.
Construction work."
"Any idea the mileage between here and Tucumcari, New Mexico?"
"Can't say I do."
$3.06.
He accepted Dick's money, made change, and said, "You'll excuse me, sir? I'm doing a job. Putting a bumper on a truck." Dick waited, ate some jelly beans, impatiently gunned the motor, sounded the horn. Was it possible that he had misjudged Perry's character? That Perry, of all people, was suffering a sudden case of blood bubbles? A year ago, when they first encountered each other, he'd thought Perry a good guy, if a bit stuck on himself, sentimental, too much the dreamer. He had liked him but not considered him especially worth cultivating until one day Perry described a murder, telling how, simply for the hell of it, he had killed a colored man in Las Vegas, beaten him to death with a bicycle chain. The anecdote elevated Dick's opinion of little Perry. He began to see more of him, and, like Willie J., though for dissimilar reasons, gradually decided that Perry possessed unusual and valuable qualities. Several murderers, or men who boasted of murder or their willingness to commit it, circulated inside Lansing. But Dick became convinced that Perry was that rarity, a natural killer. Absolutely sane, but conscienceless, and capable of dealing, with or without motive, the coldest-blooded death blows. It was Dick's theory that such a gift could, under his supervision, be profitably exploited. Having reached this conclusion, he had proceeded to woo Perry, flatter him. Pretend, for example, that he believed all the buried treasure stuff and shared his beachcomber yearnings and seaport longings, none of which appealed to Dick, who wanted a regular life with a business of his own, a house, a horse to ride, a new car, and plenty of blonde chicken. It was important, however, that Perry not suspect this. Not until Perry, with his gift, had helped further Dick's ambitions. But perhaps it was Dick who had miscalculated, been duped. If so, if it developed that Perry was, after all, only an ordinary punk, then the party was over. The months of planning were wasted. There was nothing to do but turn and go. It mustn't happen. Dick returned to the station. The door to the men's room was still bolted. He banged on it.
"For Christ's sake, Perry!"
"In a minute."
"What's the matter? You sick?"
Perry gripped the edge of the wash basin and hauled himself to a standing position. His legs trembled. The pain in his knees made him perspire. He wiped his face with a paper towel. He unlocked the door and said, "Okay, let's go." Nancy's bedroom was the smallest, most personal room in the house, girlish and as frothy as a ballerina's tutu. Walls, ceiling, and everything else except a bureau and a writing desk were pink or blue or white. The white and pink bed, piled with blue pillows, was dominated by a big pink and white teddy bear, a shooting gallery prize that Bobby had won at the county fair. A cork bulletin board, painted pink, hung above a white-skirted dressing table. Dry gardenias, the remains of some ancient corsage, were attached to it, and old valentines, newspaper recipes, and snapshots of her baby nephew and of Susan Kidwell and of Bobby Rupp, Bobby caught in a dozen actions, swinging a bat, dribbling a basketball, driving a tractor,
wading in bathing trunks at the edge of McKinney Lake, which was as far as he dared go, for he had never learned to swim. And there were photographs of the two together, Nancy and Bobby. Of these, she liked best one that showed them sitting in a leaf-dappled light amid picnic debris and looking at one another with expressions that, though unsmiling, seemed mirthful and full of delight. Other pictures, of horses, of cats deceased but unforgotten, like poor Boobs, who had died not long ago and most mysteriously, she suspected poison, encumbered her desk. Nancy was invariably the last of the family to retire. As she had once informed her friend and home economics teacher, Mrs. Polly Stringer, the midnight hours were her time to be selfish and vain. It was then that she went through her beauty routine, a cleansing, creaming ritual, which on Saturday nights included washing her hair. Tonight, having dried and brushed her hair and bound it in a gauzy bandana, she set out the clothes she intended to wear to church the next morning. Nylons, black pumps, a red velveteen dress. Her prettiest, which she herself had made. It was the dress in which she was to be buried. Before saying her prayers, she always recorded in a diary a few occurrences. Summer here. Forever, I hope. Sue over, and we rode Babe down to the river. Sue played her flute. Fireflies. And an occasional outburst. I love him. I do. It was a 5-year diary. In the 4 years of its existence, she had never neglected to make an entry, though the splendor of several events, Eviana's wedding, the birth of her nephew, and the drama of others, her first real quarrel with Bobby, a page literally tear-stained, had caused her to usurp space allotted to the future. A different tinted ink identified each year. 1956 was green, and 1957 a ribbon of red, replaced the following year by bright lavender, and now, in 1959, she had decided upon a dignified blue. But as in every manifestation, she continued to tinker with her handwriting, slanting it to the right or to the left, shaping it roundly or steeply, loosely or stingily, as though she were asking, "Is this Nancy? Or that? Or that? Which is me?" Once Mrs. Riggs, her English teacher, had returned a theme with a scribbled comment, "Good. But why written in 3 styles of script?" To which Nancy had replied, "Because I'm not grown up enough to be one person with one kind of signature." Still, she had progressed in recent months, and it was in a handwriting of emerging maturity that she wrote, "Jolene Kay came over and I showed her how to make a cherry pie. Practiced with Roxy. Bobby here and we watched TV. Left at 11. This is it. This is it. This has to be it. There's the school, there's the garage. Now we turn south." To Perry, it seemed as though Dick were muttering jubilant mumbo-jumbo. They left the highway, sped through a deserted Holcomb, and crossed the Santa Fe tracks. The bank. That must be the bank. Now we turn west. See the trees? This is it. This has to be it. The headlights disclosed a lane of Chinese elms. Bundles of wind-blown thistle scurried across it. Dick doused the headlights, slowed down, and stopped until his eyes were adjusted to the moon-illuminated night. Presently, the car crept forward. Holcomb is 12 miles east of the Mountain Time Zone border, a circumstance that causes some grumbling, for it means that at 7 in the morning, and in winter at 8 or after, the sky is still dark and the stars, if any, are still shining, as they were when the two sons of Vic Ersick arrived to do their Sunday morning chores. But by 9, when the boys finished work, during which they noticed nothing amiss, the sun had risen, delivering another day of pheasant season perfection. As they left the property and ran along the lane, they waved at an incoming car, and a girl waved back. She was a classmate of Nancy Clutter's, and her name was also Nancy. Nancy Ewalt. She was the only child of the man who was driving the car, Mr. Clarence Ewalt, a middle-aged sugar beet farmer. Mr. Ewalt was not himself a churchgoer, nor was his wife. But every Sunday he dropped his daughter at River Valley Farm in order that she might accompany the Clutter family to Methodist services in Garden City. The arrangement saved him making two back-and-forth trips to town. It was his custom to wait until he had seen his daughter safely admitted to the house. Nancy, a clothes-conscious girl with a film star figure, a bespectacled countenance, and a coy, tiptoe way of walking, crossed the lawn and pressed the front door bell. The house had four entrances, and when, after repeated knockings, there was no response at this one, she moved on to the next, that of Mr. Clutter's office. Here the door was partly open. She opened it somewhat more, enough to ascertain that the office was filled only with shadow, but she did not think the Clutters would appreciate her barging right in. She knocked, rang, and at last walked around to the back of the house. The garage was there, and she noted that both cars were in it, two Chevrolet sedans, which meant they must be home. However, having applied unavailingly at a third door, which led into a utility room, and a fourth, the door to the kitchen, she rejoined her father, who said, "Maybe they're asleep." "But that's impossible. Can you imagine Mr. Clutter missing church? Just to sleep?" "Come on, then. We'll drive down to the teacherage. Susan ought to know what's happened." The teacherage, which stands opposite the up-to-date school, is an out-of-date edifice, drab and poignant. Its 20-odd rooms are separated into grace and favor apartments for those members of the faculty unable to find or afford other quarters. Nevertheless, Susan Kidwell and her mother had managed to sugar the pill and install a cozy atmosphere in their apartment. Three rooms on the ground floor. The very small living room incredibly contained, aside from things to sit on, an organ, a piano, a garden of flowering flower pots, and usually a darting little dog and a large, drowsy cat. Susan, on this Sunday morning, stood at the window of this room watching the street. She is a tall, languid young lady with a pallid, oval face and beautiful, pale blue-gray eyes. Her hands are extraordinary, long-fingered, flexible, nervously elegant. She was dressed for church and expected momentarily to see the Clutter's Chevrolet, for she, too, always attended services chaperoned by the Clutter family. Instead, the Ewalts arrived to tell their peculiar tale. But Susan knew no explanation. Nor did her mother, who said, "If there was some change of plan, why, I'm sure they would have telephoned. Susan, why don't you call the house? They could be asleep, I suppose." "So I did," said Susan, in a statement made at a later date. "I called the house and let the phone ring. At least I had the impression it was ringing. Oh, a minute or more. Nobody answered, so Mr. Ewalt suggested that we go to the house and try to wake them up. But when we got there, I didn't want to do it. Go inside the house. I was frightened, and I don't know why, because it never occurred to me. Well, something like that just doesn't. But the sun was so bright. Everything looked too bright and quiet. And then I saw that all the cars were there. Even Kenyon's old coyote wagon. Mr. Ewalt was wearing work clothes. He had mud on his boots. He felt he wasn't properly dressed to go calling on the Clutters, especially since he never had. Been in the house, I mean. Finally, Nancy said she would go with me. We went around to the kitchen door, and, of course, it wasn't locked. The only person who ever locked doors around there was Mrs. Helm. The family never did. We walked in, and I saw right away that the Clutters hadn't eaten breakfast. There were no dishes, nothing on the stove. Then I noticed something funny. Nancy's purse. It was lying on the floor, sort of open. We passed on through the dining room and stopped at the bottom of the stairs. Nancy's room is just at the top. I called her name and started up the stairs, and Nancy Ewalt followed. The sound of our footsteps frightened me more than anything. They were so loud and everything else was so silent. Nancy's door was open. The curtains hadn't been drawn and the room was full of sunlight.
I don't remember screaming. Nancy Ewalt says I did. Screamed and screamed. I only remember Nancy's teddy bear staring at me. And Nancy. And running.
In the interim, Mr. Ewalt had decided that perhaps he ought not to have allowed the girls to enter the house alone. He was getting out of the car to go after them when he heard the screams, but before he could reach the house, the girls were running toward him. His daughter shouted, "She's dead!" and flung herself into his arms.
"It's true, Daddy. Nancy's dead."
Susan turned on her.
"No, she isn't. And don't you say it. Don't you dare. It's only a nosebleed. She has them all the time. Terrible nosebleeds, and that's all it is. There's too much blood. There's blood on the walls. You didn't really look."
I couldn't make head nor tails, Mr. Ewalt subsequently testified. I thought maybe the child was hurt. It seemed to me the first thing to do was call an ambulance. Miss Kidwell, Susan, she told me there was a telephone in the kitchen. I found it right where she said. But the receiver was off the hook, and when I picked it up, I saw the line had been cut. Larry Hendricks, a teacher of English, aged 27, lived on the top floor of the teacherage. He wanted to write, but his apartment was not the ideal lair for a would-be author. It was smaller than the Kidwells, and, moreover, he shared it with a wife, three active children, and a perpetually functioning television set. It's the only way we can keep the kids pacified. Though as yet unpublished, young Hendricks, a he-mannish ex-sailor from Oklahoma who smokes a pipe and has a mustache and a crop of untamed black hair, at least looks literary. In fact, remarkably like youthful photographs of the writer he most admires, Ernest Hemingway. To supplement his teacher's salary, he also drove a school bus. "Sometimes I cover 60 miles a day," he said to an acquaintance, "which doesn't leave much time for writing, except Sundays." Now that Sunday, November 15th, I was sitting up here in the apartment going through the papers. Most of my ideas for stories, I get them out of the newspapers, you know? Well, the TV was on and the kids were kind of lively, but even so, I could hear voices. From downstairs. Down at Mrs. Kidwell's. But I didn't figure it was my concern since I was new here. Only came to Holcomb when school began. But then Shirley, she'd been hanging up some clothes. My wife, Shirley, rushed in and said, "Honey, you better go downstairs. They're all hysterical." The two girls. Now, they really were hysterical. Susan never has got over it. Never will, ask me. And poor Mrs. Kidwell. Her health's not too good. She's high-strung to begin with. She kept saying, but it was only later I understood what she meant. She kept saying, "Oh, Bonnie, Bonnie, what happened? You were so happy. You told me it was all over. You said you'd never be sick again." Words to that effect. Even Mr. Ewalt, he was about as worked up as a man like that ever gets. He had the sheriff's office on the phone, the Garden City sheriff, and he was telling him that there was something radically wrong over at the Clutter place. The sheriff promised to come straight out, and Mr. Ewalt said fine, he'd meet him on the highway. Shirley came downstairs to sit with the women, try and calm them, as if anybody could. And I went with Mr. Ewalt, drove with him out to the highway to wait for Sheriff Robinson. On the way, he told me what had happened. When he came to the part about finding the wires cut, right then I thought, and decided I'd better keep my eyes open, make a note of every detail, in case I was ever called on to testify in court. The sheriff arrived. It was 9:35. I looked at my watch. Mr. Ewalt waved at him to follow our car, and we drove out to the Clutters. I'd never been there before, only seen it from a distance. Of course, I knew the family. Kenyon was in my sophomore English class, and I'd directed Nancy in the Tom Sawyer play. but they were such exceptional, unassuming kids you wouldn't have known they were rich or lived in such a big house. And the trees, the lawn, everything so tended and cared for. After we got there and the sheriff had heard Mr. Ewalt's story, he radioed his office and told them to send reinforcements and an ambulance. Said there's been some kind of accident. Then we went in the house, the three of us. Went through the kitchen and saw a lady's purse lying on the floor and the phone where the wires had been cut. The sheriff was wearing a hip pistol, and when we started up the stairs, going to Nancy's room, I noticed he kept his hand on it, ready to draw. Well, it was pretty bad. That wonderful girl. But you would never have known her. She'd been shot in the back of the head with a shotgun held maybe 2 inches away. She was lying on her side, facing the wall, and the wall was covered with blood. The bed covers were drawn up to her shoulders. Sheriff Robinson, he pulled them back, and we saw that she was wearing a bathrobe, pajamas, socks, and slippers. Like whenever it happened, she hadn't gone to bed yet. Her hands were tied behind her, and her ankles were roped together with a kind of cord you see on Venetian blinds. Sheriff said, "Is this Nancy Clutter?" He'd never seen the child before. And I said, "Yes. Yes, that's Nancy." We stepped back into the hall and looked around. All the other doors were closed. We opened one, and that turned out to be a bathroom. Something about it seemed wrong. I decided it was because of the chair, a sort of dining room chair that looked out of place in a bathroom. The next door, we all agreed it must be Kenyon's room. A lot of boy stuff scattered around. And I recognized Kenyon's glasses. Saw them on a bookshelf beside the bed. But the bed was empty, though it looked as if it had been slept in. So we walked to the end of the hall, the last door, and there on her bed. That's where we found Mrs. Clutter. She'd been tied too. But differently, with her hands in front of her, so that she looked as though she were praying. And in one hand she was holding, gripping, a handkerchief. Or was it Kleenex? The cord around her wrists ran down to her ankles, which were bound together, and then ran on down to the bottom of the bed where it was tied to the footboard. A very complicated, artful piece of work. Think how long it took to do. And her lying there, scared out of her wits. Well, she was wearing some jewelry, 2 rings, which is one of the reasons why I've always discounted robbery as a motive, and a robe, and a white nightgown, and white socks. Her mouth had been taped with adhesive, but she'd been shot point blank in the side of the head, and the blast, the impact, had ripped the tape loose. Her eyes were open, wide open, as though she were still looking at the killer. Because she must have had to watch him do it, aim the gun. Nobody said anything. We were too stunned. I remember the sheriff searched around to see if he could find the discharged cartridge. But whoever had done it was much too smart and cool to have left behind any clues like that. Naturally, we were wondering where was Mr. Clutter. And Kenyon. Sheriff said, "Let's try downstairs." The first place we tried was the master bedroom, the room where Mr. Clutter slept. The bed covers were drawn back, and lying there, toward the foot of the bed, was a billfold with a mess of cards spilling out of it, like somebody had shuffled through them hunting something particular. A note, an IOU, who knows? The fact that there wasn't any money in it didn't signify one way or the other. It was Mr. Clutter's billfold, and he never did carry cash. Even I knew that, and I'd only been in Holcomb a little more than 2 months. Another thing I knew was that neither Mr. Clutter nor Kenyon could see a darn without his glasses. and there were Mr. Clutter's glasses sitting on a bureau. So I figured wherever they weren't there of their own accord. We looked all over, and everything was just as it should be. No sign of a struggle, nothing disturbed. Except the office, where the telephone was off the hook and the wires cut, same as in the kitchen. Sheriff Robinson, he found some shotguns in a closet and sniffed them to see if they had been fired recently. Said they hadn't, and I never saw a more bewildered man. Said, "Where the devil can Herb be?" About then we heard footsteps coming up the stairs from the basement. "Who's that?" said the sheriff, like he was ready to shoot. And a voice said, "It's me, Wendell." Turned out to be Wendell Meyer, the undersheriff. Seems he had come to the house and hadn't seen us, so he'd gone investigating down in the basement. The sheriff told him, and it was sort of pitiful, "Wendell, I don't know what to make of it. There's two bodies upstairs." "Well," he said, Wendell did, "there's another one down here." So we followed him down to the basement, or playroom, I guess you'd call it. It wasn't dark. There were windows that let in plenty of light. Kenyon was over in a corner, lying on a couch. He was gagged with adhesive tape and bound hand and foot like the mother. The same intricate process of the cord leading from the hands to the feet and finally tied to an arm of the couch. Somehow he haunts me the most, Kenyon does. I think it's because he was the most recognizable, the one that looked the most like himself. Even though he'd been shot in the face directly, head on. He was wearing a t-shirt and blue jeans, and he was barefoot, as though he'd dressed in a hurry, just put on the first thing that came to hand. His head was propped by a couple of pillows, like they'd been stuffed under him to make an easier target. Then the sheriff said, "Where's this go to?" Meaning another door there in the basement. Sheriff led the way, but inside you couldn't see your hand until Mr. Ewalt found the light switch. It was a furnace room, and very warm. Around here, people just install a gas furnace and pump the gas smack out of the ground. Doesn't cost them a nickel. That's why all the houses are overheated. Well, I took one look at Mr. Clutter, and it was hard to look again. I knew plain shooting couldn't account for that much blood. And I wasn't wrong. He'd been shot all right, the same as Kenyon, with the gun held right in front of his face. But probably he was dead before he was shot. Or anyway, dying, because his throat had been cut, too. He was wearing striped pajamas. Nothing else. His mouth was taped. The tape had been wound plumb around his head. His ankles were tied together, but not his hands. Or rather, he'd managed, God knows how, maybe in rage or pain, to break the cord binding his hands. He was sprawled in front of the furnace, on a big cardboard box that looked as though it had been laid there specially. A mattress box. Sheriff said, "Look here, Wendell." What he was pointing at was a blood-stained footprint on the mattress box. A half-sole footprint with circles, two holes in the center like a pair of eyes. Then one of us, Mr. Ewalt, I don't recall, pointed out something else. A thing I can't get out of my mind. There was a steam pipe overhead, and knotted to it. Dangling from it was a piece of cord, the kind of cord the killer had used. Obviously, at some point, Mr. Clutter had been tied there, strung up by his hands, and then cut down. But why? To torture him? I don't guess we'll ever know. Ever know who did it, or why, or what went on in that house that night. After a bit, the house began to fill up, Ambulances arrived, and the coroner, and the Methodist minister, a police photographer, state troopers, fellas from the radio and the newspaper. Oh, a bunch. Most of them had been called out of church and acted as though they were still there. Very quiet. Whispery. It was like nobody could believe it. A state trooper asked me did I have any official business there and said if not, then I'd better leave. Outside on the lawn, I saw the undersheriff talking to a man, Alfred Stokeline, the hired man. Seems Stokeline lived not 100 yards from the Clutter House, with nothing between his place and theirs except a barn. But he was saying as to how he hadn't heard a sound. Said, I didn't know a thing about it till 5 minutes ago when one of my kids come running in and told us the sheriff was here. The missus and me, we didn't sleep 2 hours last night. Was up and down the whole time on account of we got a sick baby. But the only thing we heard, about 10:30, 10:45, I heard a car drive away, and I made the remark to Mrs., there goes Bob Rupp. I started walking home, and on the way, about halfway down the lane, I saw Kenyon's old collie, and that dog was scared. Stood there with its tail between its legs, didn't bark or move. And seeing the dog, somehow that made me feel again. I'd been too dazed, too numb to feel the full viciousness of it. The suffering, the horror. They were dead. A whole family. Gentle, kindly people. People I knew. Murdered. You had to believe it. Because it was really true. 8 non-stop passenger trains hurry through Holcomb every 24 hours. Of these, 2 pick up and deposit mail. An operation that, as the person in charge of it fervently explains, has its tricky side. Yes, sir. You've got to keep on your toes. Them trains come through here, sometimes they're going 100 miles an hour. The breeze alone, why, it's enough to knock you down. And when those mail sacks come flying out, sakes alive, it's like playing tackle on a football team. Wham! 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 Not that I'm complaining, mind you. It's honest work, government work, and it keeps me young. Holcomb's mail messenger, Mrs. Sadie Truitt, or Mother Truitt, as the townspeople call her, does seem younger than her years, which amount to 75. A stocky, weathered widow who wears babushka bandanas and cowboy boots. Most comfortable things you can put on your feet, soft as a loon feather. Mother Truitt is the oldest native-born Holcombite. Time wasn't anybody here wasn't my kin. Them days we called this place Sherlock. Then along came this stranger, by the name Holcomb. A hog raiser he was. Made money and decided the town ought to be called after him. Soon as it was, what did he do? Sold out. Moved to California. Not us. I was born here. My children was born here. And here we are. One of her children is Mrs. Myrtle Clare, who happens to be the local postmistress. Only don't go thinking that's how I got this position with the government. Mert didn't even want me to have it. But it's a job you bid for. Goes to whoever puts in the lowest bid. And I always do. So low a caterpillar could peek over it. Ha ha! That sure does rile the boys. Lots of boys would like to be mail messenger, yes sir. But I don't know how much they'd like it when the snow's high as old Mr. Primo Carnera and the wind's blowing blue hard and those sacks come sailing. Ugh! Wham! In Mother Truitt's profession, Sunday is a work day like any other. On November 15th, while she was waiting for the westbound 10:32, she was astonished to see 2 ambulances cross the railroad tracks and turn toward the Clutter property. The incident provoked her into doing what she had never done before, abandon her duties. Let the mail fall where it may, this was news that Mert must hear at once. The people of Holcomb speak of their post office as the Federal Building, which seems rather too substantial a title to confer on a drafty and dusty shed. The ceiling leaks, the floorboards wobble, the mailboxes won't shut, the light bulbs are broken, the clock has stopped. Yes, it's a disgrace, agrees the caustic, somewhat original, and entirely imposing lady who presides over this litter. But the stamps work, don't they? Anyhow, what do I care? Back here in my part is real cozy. I've got my rocker, and a nice wood stove, and a coffee pot, and plenty to read. Mrs. Clare is a famous figure in Finney County. Her celebrity derives not from her present occupation, but a previous one. Dance hall hostess, an incarnation not indicated by her appearance. She is a gaunt, trouser-wearing, woolen-shirted, cowboy-booted, ginger-colored, gingery-tempered woman of unrevealed age. That's for me to know, and you to guess. But promptly revealed opinions, most of which are announced in a voice of rooster-crow altitude and penetration. Until 1955, she and her late husband operated the Holcomb Dance Pavilion, an enterprise that, owing to its uniqueness in the area, attracted from 100 miles around a fast-drinking, fancy-stepping clientele, whose behavior, in turn, attracted the interest of the sheriff now and then. We had some tough times, all right, says Mrs. Clare, reminiscing. Some of those bow-legged country boys, you give them a little hooch and they're like redskins. Want to scalp everything in sight. Course, we only sold setups, never the hard stuff itself. Wouldn't have, even if it was legal. My husband, Homer Clare, he didn't hold with it. Neither did I. One day, Homer Clare, he passed on 7 months and 12 days ago today after a 5-hour operation out in Oregon. He said to me, Mert, we've lived all our lives in hell. Now we're going to die in heaven. The next day, we closed the dance hall. I've never regretted it. Oh, along at first, I missed being a night owl. The tunes, the jollity. But now that Homer's gone, I'm just glad to do my work here at the Federal Building. Sit a spell. Drink a cup of coffee. In fact, on that Sunday morning, Mrs. Clare had just poured herself a cup of coffee from a freshly brewed pot when Mother Truitt returned. Mert, she said, but could say no more until she had caught her breath. Mert, there's 2 ambulances gone to the Clutters. Her daughter said, where's the 1032? Ambulances? Gone to the Clutters? Well, what about it? It's only Bonnie, having one of her spells. Where's the 1032? Mother Truitt subsided. As usual, Mert knew the answer. Was enjoying the last word. Then a thought occurred to her. But Mert, if it's only Bonnie, why would there be 2 ambulances? A sensible question, as Mrs. Clare, an admirer of logic, though a curious interpreter of it, was driven to admit. She said she would telephone Mrs. Helm. Mabel will know, she said. The conversation with Mrs. Helm lasted several minutes and was most distressing to Mother Truitt, who could hear nothing of it except the non-committal monosyllabic responses of her daughter. Worse, when the daughter hung up, she did not quench the old woman's curiosity. Instead, she placidly drank her coffee, went to her desk, and began to postmark a pile of letters. Mert, Mother Truitt said. For heaven's sake, what did Mabel say? I'm not surprised, Mrs. Clare said. When you think how Herb Clutter spent his whole life in a hurry, rushing in here to get his mail with never a minute to say good morning and thank you, dog, rushing around like a chicken with his head off, joining clubs, running everything, getting jobs maybe other people wanted. And now look, it's all caught up with him. Well, he won't be rushing any more. Why, Mert? Why won't he? Mrs. Clare raised her voice. Because he's dead. And Bonnie, too. And Nancy. And the boy. Somebody shot them.
Mert, don't say things like that. Who shot them?
Without a pause in her postmarking activities, Mrs. Clare replied, "The man in the airplane. The one Herb sued for crashing into his fruit trees. If it wasn't him, maybe it was you. Or somebody across the street. All the neighbors are rattlesnakes. Varmints looking for a chance to slam the door in your face. It's the same the whole world over. You know that."
"I don't," said Mother Truitt, who put her hands over her ears. "I don't know any such thing."
"Varmints."
"I'm scared, Mert."
"Of what? When your time comes, it comes. And tears won't save you."
She had observed that her mother had begun to shed a few.
"When Homer died, I used up all the fear I had in me, and all the grief, too. If there's somebody loose around here that wants to cut my throat, I wish him luck. What difference does it make? It's all the same in eternity.
Just remember, if one bird carried every grain of sand, grain by grain, across the ocean, by the time he got them all on the other side, that would only be the beginning of eternity. So blow your nose."
The grim information, announced from church pulpits, distributed over telephone wires, publicized by Garden City's radio station, KIUL, a tragedy, unbelievable and shocking beyond words, struck four members of the Herb Clutter family late Saturday night or early today. Death, brutal and without apparent motive, produced in the average recipient a reaction nearer that of Mother Truitt than that of Mrs. Clare. Amazement, shading into dismay. A shallow horror sensation that cold springs of personal fear swiftly deepened. Hartman's Cafe, which contains four roughly made tables and a lunch counter, could accommodate but a fraction of the frightened gossips, mostly male, who wished to gather there. The owner, Mrs. Bess Hartman, a sparsely fleshed, unfoolish lady with bobbed gray and gold hair and bright, authoritative green eyes, is a cousin of postmistress Clare, whose style of candor Mrs. Hartman can equal, perhaps surpass. "Some people say I'm a tough old bird, but the clutter business sure took the fly out of me," she later said to a friend. "Imagine anybody pulling a stunt like that. Time I heard it, when everybody was pouring in here talking all kinds of wild-eyed stuff, my first thought was Bonnie. Of course, it was silly, but we didn't know the facts, and a lot of people thought, maybe, on account of her spells. Now we don't know what to think. It must have been a grudge killing, done by somebody who knew the house inside out. But who hated the Clutters? I never heard a word against them. They were about as popular as a family can be, and if something like this could happen to them, then who's safe, I ask you? One old man sitting here that Sunday, he put his finger right on it, the reason nobody can sleep. He said, all we've got out here are our friends. There isn't anything else. In a way, that's the worst part of the crime. What a terrible thing when neighbors can't look at each other without kind of wondering. Yes, it's a hard fact to live with. But if they ever do find out who done it, I'm sure it'll be a bigger surprise than the murders themselves. Mrs. Bob Johnson, the wife of the New York life insurance agent, is an excellent cook, but the Sunday dinner she had prepared was not eaten, at least not while it was warm. For just as her husband was plunging a knife into the roast pheasant, he received a telephone call from a friend. "And that," he recalls rather ruefully, "was the first I heard of what had happened in Holcomb. I didn't believe it. I couldn't afford to. Lord, I had Clutter's check right here in my pocket. A piece of paper worth $80,000. If what I'd heard was true. But I thought, it can't be. There must be some mistake. Things like that don't happen. You don't sell a man a big policy one minute and he's dead the next. Murdered. Meaning double indemnity. I didn't know what to do. I called the manager of our office in Wichita. Told him how I had the check but hadn't put it through and asked what was his advice. Well, it was a delicate situation. It appeared that legally we weren't obliged to pay. But morally, that was another matter. Naturally, we decided to do the moral thing. The two persons who benefited by this honorable attitude, Eviana Jarchow and her sister Beverly, sole heirs to their father's estate, were within a few hours of the awful discovery on their way to Garden City, Beverly traveling from Winfield, Kansas, where she had been visiting her fiancé, and Eviana from her home in Mount Carroll, Illinois. Gradually, in the course of the day, other relatives were notified, among them Mr. Clutter's father, his two brothers, Arthur and Clarence, and his sister, Mrs. Harry Nelson, all of Larned, Kansas, and a second sister, Mrs. Elaine Seltzer, of Palatka, Florida. Also the parents of Bonnie Clutter, Mr. and Mrs. Arthur B. Fox, who live in Pasadena, California, and her three brothers, Harold, of Visalia, California, Howard, of Oregon, Illinois, and Glenn, of Kansas City, Kansas. Indeed, the better part of those on the Clutter's Thanksgiving guest list were either telephoned or telegraphed, and the majority set forth at once for what was to be a family reunion not around a groaning board, but at the graveside of a mass burial. At the Teacherage, Wilma Kidwell was forced to control herself in order to control her daughter, for Susan, puffy-eyed, sickened by spasms of nausea, argued, inconsolably insisted that she must go, must run the 3 miles to the Rupp farm. "Don't you see, Mother?" she said. "If Bobby just hears it?" "He loved her. We both did. I have to be the one to tell him." But Bobby already knew. On his way home, Mr. Ewalt had stopped at the Rupp farm and consulted with his friend Johnny Rupp, the father of 8, of whom Bobby is the 3rd. Together, the two men went to the bunkhouse, a building separate from the farmhouse proper, which is too small to shelter all the Rupp children. The boys live in the bunkhouse, the girls at home. They found Bobby making his bed. He listened to Mr. Ewalt, asked no questions, and thanked him for coming. Afterward, he stood outside in the sunshine. The Rupp property is on a rise, an exposed plateau, from which he could see the harvested, glowing land of River Valley Farm, scenery that occupied him for perhaps an hour. Those who tried to distract him could not. The dinner bell sounded, and his mother called to him to come inside. Called until finally her husband said, "No, I'd leave him alone." Larry, a younger brother, also refused to obey the summoning bell. He circled around Bobby, helpless to help but wanting to, even though he was told to go away. Later, when his brother stopped standing and started to walk, heading down the road and across the fields toward Holcomb, Larry pursued him. "Hey, Bobby, listen. If we're going somewhere, why don't we go in the car?" His brother wouldn't answer. He was walking with purpose, running, really, but Larry had no difficulty keeping stride. Though only 14, he was the taller of the two, the deeper-chested, the longer-legged, Bobby being, for all his athletic honors, rather less than medium size. Compact, but slender, a finely made boy with an open, homely, handsome face. "Hey, Bobby, listen. They won't let you see her. It won't do any good." Bobby turned on him and said, "Go back. Go home." The younger brother fell behind, then followed at a distance. Despite the pumpkin season temperature, the day's arid glitter, both boys were sweating as they approached a barricade that state troopers had erected at the entrance to River Valley Farm. Many friends of the Clutter family, and strangers from all over Finney County as well, had assembled at the site, but none was allowed past the barricade, which, soon after the arrival of the Rupp brothers, was briefly lifted to permit the exit of 4 ambulances, the number finally required to remove the victims, and a car filled with men from the sheriff's office. Men who, even at that moment, were mentioning the name of Bobby Rupp. For Bobby, as he was to learn before nightfall, was their principal